I'm Macy Chen.
And I'm David Ball.
You're listening to CFRO, The Pulse, here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
We are your independent daily news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
And we're streaming at thepulse.coopradio.org.
Good morning. It's Thursday, August the 6th, and on The Pulse today, we're talking to Mira Aragoda. Mira is a history major at Simon Fraser University who's examining and challenging colonial narratives of history making. And Mira is also the arts and culture editor at SFU's The Peak newspaper. We're talking about the history of parks and how current debates over Strathcona Park being used for a tent city or before at Oppenheimer Park or Crab Park actually underlie a vast history around racism, colonialism, and displacement. We're going to find out who parks are for and why many were created in the first place. First, though, our news headlines. Now, the Downtown Eastside Women's Center is giving thanks to a number of business donors in the city who they say have, quote, brightened our spirits and provided for women in the Downtown Eastside with generous donations. Those include 1,000 masks dropped off by West Coast Opportunity Accelerator, they said, in very much a time of need. The founders of West Coast Opportunity Accelerator, on their Facebook page, said that they, quote, heard the Downtown Eastside Women's Center's call to action for more masks that were needed, and they said that they encouraged other people to join the call and look on their website for more goodies to help serve the hundreds of women residing in the Downtown Eastside. As well, there are hundreds of cross-stitch kits for women to use with manuals and magazines donated, and 300 cloth masks for women from Checkpoint One Apparel Corporation. And the Powell Street Festival, which fundraised over $40,000 at its telethon last weekend, dropped off a series of care packages for women at the drop-in center. Since they cannot hold a physical festival, they're donating the money to Downtown Eastside care packages and developing a community kitchen in the neighborhood. Here's Powell Street Festival Society Executive Director Emiko Morita.
We have some dried goods and hand sanitizer, face masks, some things to really fulfill people's essential needs. Is symbolic of the reciprocal relationship that we have with the neighborhood and the people in the neighborhood, we being the Japanese Canadian community. Some 1,500 care packages that we'll be distributing, and we look forward to connecting with people through the meal program in the fall once we get it off the ground. Great things happen when people come together to prepare a meal.
As well, the group The Sewing Angels continued to give support and mask donations. The organization is always looking for support, and you can find out more about them at their website, dewc.ca. They say that in particular, donations of reusable face masks, as well as travel-sized shampoo and conditioner and sanitary wipes, toothbrushes and toothpaste, deodorant, soap, pads and tampons, are always welcome. They also said that this weekend they're looking for volunteers to help mail out their newsletter. They said although it's monotonous work, the newsletter helps, quote, connect our community to the stories, news, and spirit of the Downtown Eastside Women's Center. They're looking for volunteers this weekend on August 11th and 12th from 10 to 6 p.m. You can email Ali at engagement.dewc.ca. And because it's held in the administration office, all genders are welcome to help participate and contribute to the work of the Downtown Eastside Women's Center. And if you want to attend the center, it is still open for drop-in centers with full hours again, and offers physical distancing while limiting the number of people inside. It's offering meals and takeaway and to-go containers, as well as picnic tables outside for outdoor seating. Its bathroom and showers remain open. COVID cases have risen slightly, up to 319 active cases on Wednesday, up from 240 just 2 days ago. It's as bad as it was on May the 25th, and it's continued to very slowly rise. The number of deaths remains the same over the last week at 195. 3,800 people have now caught COVID in the province. 3,200 of those have recovered. Canada-wide, the number of cases has neared 120,000 cases total. 102,000 have recovered. There are 6,500 active cases and nearly 9,000 deaths. The number of active cases, or new cases, I should say, has continued declining over the past week. There are now 390 new cases a day, down from 500 last week. Worldwide, We now have nearly 19 million coronavirus cases, and the number of deaths has almost hit 710,000 people killed by COVID-19. The U.S. leads the pack with almost 5 million total cases, 50,000 new cases in one day. That's from 54,000 new cases the day before and 48,000 the day before that as cases accelerate. And that's it for your news headlines on today's The Pulse. Welcome back. You're listening to The Pulse on CFRO 100.5 FM, and you can find all of our episodes and previous interviews online at thepulse.coopradio.org or download it wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'm David Ball. Well, as debate over the Strathcona tent city continues to escalate, with claims of criminality and violence plaguing the neighborhood, and tent city advocates and residents saying that's simply not true, we'll actually look at what parks are for after a email from the Step Up Homeowners Organization said that the parks had become, quote, unusable to the public. Well, what is the public and what is the expected use of parks is a question that's been interesting. Historian Mira Aragoda. Mira is a history student at the Simon Fraser University and also the current arts and culture editor at SFU's The Peak newspaper. Recently, Mira published a story on the Tyee called Tent Cities and the Violent Origins of Vancouver's Parks. Here's Mira Aragoda. Mira, thank you so much for joining us here on The Pulse. Great to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Great to have you. Can you first of all tell us a little bit about your research and your history work at SFU?
So I am currently in my third year of the history undergrad program, and my primary interest is Canadian history. A little bit about myself. I'm a racialized immigrant settler. I moved to Canada from Sri Lanka in, 1999 or 2000. And as kind of a result of the civil war that was going on at the time. And, you know, when I was in Toronto and when I was here, going to kind of like the colonial school system, I never really learned about the Indigenous history. And the little that was taught was kind of, there were Indigenous people, now they're not really here at the end. When, you know, once I started actually paying attention to the true history of, you know, the place that we call Canada, I realized just how incomplete it was and how much history of Indigenous history and also like other racialized and working class histories don't get told. So that's my specific interest in history.
So tell me a little bit about why you started looking into parks in Vancouver. What was it that sparked this? We've been talking about this a lot since Oppenheimer Park and then Crab Park and now Strathcona Park all had tent cities. But what kind of jumped out at you?
Well, it's kind of that understanding of how the history or the city officials have always treated Indigenous people, how, you know, all of Canada is kind of founded on genocide and displacement, and understanding that given that a disproportionate of unhoused people in Vancouver are Indigenous, seeing that as kind of like the ongoing colonial trauma of the genocide and dispossession and displacement. And that also kind of like intersecting with criminalization of poverty and how, you know, oftentimes poor people are deemed as dangerous, and all these things that really should be social problems are stigmatized and criminalized, and the only recourse is punishment, when in reality, there, if you can take away all these like systems of criminalization, and then you can actually, you know, look at the root cause and do something to change that.
So let's talk about parks, the history of parks. And you wrote an article that was really great for the Tyee called Tent Cities and the Violent Origins of Vancouver's Parks. Tell me a little bit about that history and what you learned.
So I never really fully answered your previous question. So during the time that the media was depicting Tent Cities and the Tent City specifically at Oppenheimer Park as this very dangerous place and this place where crime was running rampant, I was living on Main and Powell, and the image that was presented to me in the media was different from my experience being in the downtown east side and not feeling unsafe. Like it's honestly the number of people that are around, it makes me feel safer than some other neighborhoods in Vancouver. And now also during COVID and having to deal with all these restrictions, parks are one of kind of like the only places that people could go to. And, you know, having parks as a space for people to find shelter and people to find a sense of community and for people to, be able to look out for each other, I think that's really important. And so for myself, I don't know, being in these neighborhoods where, I don't know, there are all these conversations about safety of tent cities, I've never, again, like never really felt unsafe. So that's kind of like where my interest in that came in, was challenging the narrative of tent cities being bad, essentially. And then, your next question was about...
Well, kind of the history of parks. So you kind of talk about the history of Stanley Park and the history of, you know, the parks movement in North America is actually being part of a colonial and racist kind of project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely is. And like you said, Stanley Park was the first park in Vancouver, and it was created by people who had connections to the Canadian Pacific Railway and connections to land speculation, who realized that if they construct this park and follow in the footsteps of what had already happened with the parks movement in the States, that would help them increase property values. And if you look at any of the urban planning documents that the city of Vancouver has, you'll see that so much of the discussion around parks is about increasing the value of the neighborhoods that the parks were supposed to be created in, and really kind of being able to attract people with money to settle these areas.
And of course, Stanley Park, I believe, had a couple villages on it and some tree burial grounds, and now is, you know, home to what appear to be like Haida totem poles. Like, it's sort of this displacement and then replacement.
Yeah, and that's so interesting too, because it's kind of saying like, oh, we want to use this park for people to enjoy, but in order to do that, you have to get out. So it's really making it clear that there's a specific type of person that was welcome in these parks, and that type of person was not Indigenous, was not racialized, was not poor. And like you said, yes, there were two Indigenous villages, Squamish and Musqueam villages, Woy-woy and Chaytus. And one of the late chief of the Squamish Nation, August Jack Catalano, he was born in Stanley Park, and this went against the construction of the park that like colonial officials were trying to create. So even if you look at the Vancouver archives, the archivist who was recording August Jack's life wrote down that his birthplace was Sanok on the Quetzalano Reserve Number 6, and not where he was actually born, which was in Stanley Park, because that was being used to house Indigenous people, to house Chinese immigrants, to house other working class people.
And of course, Chief Castellano eventually lived on that reservation, but it was larger than the IR6 that was eventually allocated to them. It would have included parts of Vanier Park and the seawall under the Burrard Bridge there. So there's another instance where they were displaced, put on boats, and I understand their houses were burned when they were moved across to North Vancouver. So another park kind of situation.
Yeah, exactly. And so now we have Vanier Park there, but you know, before that, there were people that were actually living there. And it's also interesting because the Museum of Vancouver is there now, and they do this acknowledgement on tours where they say, where they acknowledge that they're located on a former settlement of the Squamish Nation, but they don't really talk about Sanaq and talk about, you know, what went into, like, why it's no longer there.
It's interesting kind of thinking of this history, because there's this email I wanted to read to you from this homeowners group about Strathcona Park, Tent City. It's from Step Up Group, and they've been concerned about speculation tax and things that cause property values to go up, basically, or to go down, sorry, and they want less taxes. But they've said that Strathcona Tent City has, quote, rendered the park unusable for much of the general public, families with children. They said that even Oppenheimer did that, creating a dangerous and volatile area, and that substantial resources were required to restore Oppenheimer Park for public use. And I thought that the definition of public use and access is something pretty pivotal to this discussion. Which public and what use?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's so interesting. It goes to what I was saying about how parks were constructed by people who wanted to use them as tools to have property values go up and to make money off selling parcels of land to other settlers. And yeah, like, parks have been deemed public, but they've never been public, because if they were for the use of, you know, everybody, then there wouldn't have needed to be a displacement of people off those lands in the first place. And I mean, it's really interesting that, like, we even consider these spaces public spaces, because they're clearly spaces for middle class use, for use of people in the professional managerial class. And this is anecdotal experience, but during you know, the height of the COVID-19 restrictions, I was using Woodland Park quite a lot, and walking through Strathcona Park and walking through Mackenzie Park, and most of the people that I saw occupying those spaces were largely white. And so I think this goes back to this history of keeping racialized people out of parks and, you know, creating them as spaces just for a certain type of person. And it's also most parks also not only displace Indigenous people, but they also displaced a lot of Indigenous plant life and other types of nature, and then put in introduced species. And there aren't really, aside from Stanley Park and maybe Clark Park now, there aren't really any parks that actually have cedars or Douglas firs or anything like that. So I think that also goes to this idea of, you know, Indigenous stewardship over the land, and like Indigenous people understanding the different kinship relationships with the various plants and trees and animals, and the importance of all of that and sustaining those relationships. And, you know, like, all of that was displaced to put in just this patch of grass and specifically spaced out trees.
In your article in the Tyee, you also talked about internment camps, and part of that was because the Oppenheimer area was originally Japantown. But people were actually displaced to essentially a concentration camp at the P&E grounds, which itself is a parkland with these kind of Art Deco staircases and landscape features. So once again, there's another example in Vancouver.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point that you bring up, actually, is all these, there are so many locations around Vancouver and around Canada that were used as, in this instance, to intern Japanese Canadians, and also to use the same kind of rhetoric that's used now against unhoused people, and depict them as dangerous and you know, needing to kind of like seeing them as a threat that the colonial government needed to squash. And that's kind of what's happening here as well. And like, even Banff National Park was the site of an internment camp for Ukrainians in World War I. So there's all of this insidious history that goes into parks and into the creation of parks, but we somehow see them as these pristine spaces that, you know, we're entitled to when, I don't know, that's not really the case at all.
I remember when I took geography years ago at university, they talked about the idea of the sort of modern conservation park in North America as being itself a colonial kind of construction. If it in the cases where they weren't allowed to, for instance, have indigenous hunting or traditional uses. And I think a lot more parks are now starting to go back and say, you know, there are tribal parks now, or there are shared management parks like Guayanas or in the South Okanagan. But the traditional idea was no hunting, no fishing, no trapping, no medicine collection for anybody. But it really meant nothing for indigenous people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things about Banff as well. The government banned hunting for the Stoney Nation and for other Indigenous nations, but allowed it for people who wanted to do it for sport, like white settlers who wanted to do it for sport. That was okay, but people actually having a relationship with the land was really frowned upon and not allowed. And I think there's this idea of in the, you know, the history of the environmental movement, which has been to like remove yourself from the land, and see it as this separate thing somehow, when, you know, paying attention to Indigenous voices, that's not really, like, you need to steward the land, you need to maintain a sustainable relationship with it. It doesn't mean just like leaving it untouched and as this pristine wilderness for, you know, a certain group of people to occasionally go in and enjoy.
It's so interesting that you say that, because it reminds me, I've been doing some research about archaeology and anthropology, and it is interesting how this idea of the sort of sympathetic savior from Europe, who was trying to, you know, people trying to save indigenous artifacts and cultures by putting them in museums, and in doing so actually taking away the heritage. And with parks, it's like we're trying to save nature from this idea that humans are all bad for nature, when in fact that's not the case. That's a very white understanding of the relationship to the land.
Yeah, it definitely is. And like, as you talked about with Stanley Park, actual indigenous villagers were displaced, but then the city, you know, erected totem poles from nations that are not the host nations to like kind of profit off this like nostalgia of indigenous people being in the past. It's when, like, you know, at the same time as they were actively oppressing indigenous people in the present, it's kind of, you know, ridiculous to say the least.
Are there any historical resources you'd suggest for people who are interested in learning more about how parks, you know, may not be what we think they are, or how they evolved?
So I would recommend Inventing Stanley Park, because I think it talks about parks as this construct, not as a naturally occurring place. It's a place that needed to be created, and it needed to be created through displacement.
This is by Sean Kerrage.
Yes, it's by Sean Kerrage. And Jean Barman has also written a lot about Vancouver parks. And then I think just any of the I know that Carnegie Community Action Project just put out a newsletter in July, and that talked about Crab Park and how that used to be used as fishing sites and campsites and indigenous gathering places before, like long before it was created into, you know, the colonial construct of a park.
And one thing I think is that we're blessed by a number of projects over the decades that have put up new plaques that give a lot of history of our city from so many perspectives. Like, more than any other city I've ever lived in, you can learn everything from indigenous and queer histories to migrant histories to working class history with just looking on the lampposts, and there's these colorful plaques in almost every neighborhood of the city and in Stanley Park.
Yeah, and I think that's all obviously great, bringing that information to people. But then I think, you know, if the park board does things like agrees to put up plaques, but then promotes bylaws that are going to actively be displacing people every day, I don't really see that as supporting the idea of reconciliation at all. And it kind of just is not the same as just erecting totem poles in Stanley Park, but because it's actually, you know, being truthful about the history, but it's kind of not enough to like stop there.
It assumes that history is only in the past.
Yes. Yeah.
How do you see history?
Yeah, that's actually very interesting. I've been thinking about the term history a lot and how it's kind of used in kind of mainstream spaces to only sort of refer to events that happen in the past. But I think, you know, from studying any kind of history, the Canadian history, colonial history specifically, all of these things that have happened in the past are still ongoing today. You know, like the city is still enforcing displacements. The city is still denying Indigenous sovereignty. Like, so I understand that the term history is kind of, you know, the sort of the only one we have, but I would hope that people will start to think of it less as events that happened in the past that are done and are you know, taken care of, and see it more as an ongoing sort of pattern.
That's powerful and a good reminder that apparently the Greek definition, the origin of the word history, actually just means inquiry and knowledge from investigation. Well, thank you so much for your time, Mira. It's great to talk to you, and I hope people read your article on the Tai'i. It was really informative and quite a different take on this whole discussion we're having about Tent City. So thank you.
Thank you for inviting me, David.
Much appreciated. Stay healthy.
You too.
And that was Mira Arrigota, a historian at the Simon Fraser University and editor of culture at SFU's The Peak newspaper. You can find Mira's article in the Tai'i, Tent Cities and the Violent Origins of Vancouver's Parks, at thetai'i.ca.
And that's our program for CFRO, The Pulse.
Your independent news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
Every weekday, 7 a.m., here on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
Find our previous podcasts and interviews at thepulse.coopradio.org.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.